Hello, everyone. I just want to let you know first that I'm recording this talk after the fact, so it may sound a little less live. The reason for that is that on the Wednesday following our practice period opening retreat, just as I was about to give this talk, we had a power outage here at Blue Mountain Zendo. So Zoom cut out, and fortunately, just before we started practice, just before 7, there was a flicker, so we thought, let's grab the cell phone and River's phone number so we can call River in case the power goes out, which is what we did. And I was able to give this talk over the phone, and people could actually hear it over Zoom through River's laptop mic. So it was sort of another miraculous extension of the kind of adaptation we've been doing, and so many have been doing, practicing through the pandemic and working and devising ways to keep going, creative solutions. So many thanks to River for helping out that night. And the one thing we neglected to do is record the talk. So here goes. I'm going to talk about the first paramita, generosity, dana. It is typically the first paramita in any list because it cultivates the ground for the others. It tenderizes the heart and dissolves the separation between self and other. It allows us to see all the ways we withhold what we offer to the world, what we could offer to the world, barricading ourselves behind all the many conditioned divisions we create between self and other, even between self and self. Through choosing to give, choosing to make an offering of our lives, however imperfect, we begin to let down those barriers, and we begin to question what they were even made of. There are probably more stories about generosity than any other paramita in the folklore of Buddhist cultures. Over the weekend, one thing I talked about was stories, and how over these weeks of the practice period, one thing that we want to do is expand our narrow, constricted, conditioned story about ourselves and the world, and make a boundless, spacious story within which we speak and act creatively. Michael mentioned the Jataka tales in his talk during the retreat, the folk tales of the past lives of Shakyamuni Buddha. Many of them are about the generous acts of the Buddha, or the Buddha-to-be, the Bodhisattva, as he was called, in many different forms. In one of the best known, he was a prince out hunting with his retinue one day and encountered a starving mother tiger with her thin cubs, and he allowed the mother tiger to kill him out of compassion so that she and her cubs would survive. In Japan, there are countless folk tales of the generosity and compassion of Jizo, the Bodhisattva of Great Vow, and also Kannon, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. According to legend, Jizo appeared to the Buddha when he was dying and vowed to complete the Buddha's work of teaching and liberating all beings. The Sanskrit name for Jizo is Akshitagarbha, and the Sutra of the Past Vows of Akshitagarbha Bodhisattva tells the story of Akshitagarbha's great vow. goes like this, or part of it goes like this. At the time of his death, the Buddha said, I have worked hard for many kalpas to liberate obstinate living beings. Those who have not yet understood the Dharma will surely fall into states of suffering. Kshitagarbha Bodhisattva said, even if their good deeds are as little as a hair, a drop of water, a grain of sand, a mote of dust, or a bit of down, I shall gradually help living beings to liberation. World honored one, do not feel distressed over beings in generations to come. And he repeated this vow 3 times. Shakyamuni Buddha was delighted and said, my blessings, I appreciate your strong vows and praise you for your efforts to heal the human world. When you fulfill this great vow, after many kalpas, you will become a Buddha. We could say that the greatest gift, the greatest generosity we can offer is to undertake the Bodhisattva vows. To make the vow to awaken for the benefit of all beings. I thought I would tell a story about Jizo Bodhisattva that every Japanese schoolchild is likely to know. It's called Kasa Jizo, or a straw hat for Jizo. A kasa is a kind of conical straw hat used to for protection from the sun or rain. And the night I gave this talk, I felt like I was sitting in the dark in our zendo with our camping flashlight lantern, and it felt kind of like sitting around a campfire telling a story to people out there in Zoomland. So this is how it goes. These folk tales in Japan typically begin Mukashi Mukashi, long, long ago. In the deep countryside of northern Japan, the snow country, lived a very poor elderly couple. It was New Year's Eve, and they had no rice to make traditional mochi cakes. The old woman said, I've made all these nice balls of red yarn. Why don't you take them to the village, market, and see if you can sell them and buy some mochi cakes? So the old man set out, trudging through the snow deeper and deeper as he approached Jizo Pass. At the pass, there was a crossroads where 6 Jizo statues stood in a row, with the snow piled on their heads like white hats. I should say that Jizo is considered to be the protector of travelers, and also particularly of children and women. And you also often see groups of 6 Jizos at crossroads all over Japan, thousands and thousands of them, because their Jizo is said to travel the 6 realms, saving all beings. The 6 realms, the heavenly realm, the human, the hungry ghost realm, the hell realm, the animal realm, and the angry titan realm. So as the old man passed the Jizo, the 6 Jizos, he brushed the snow from each Jizo's head, saying, oh, you must be cold. I'll bring back a mochi cake for you. When he arrived, the village market was busy with people stocking up for the New Year's holidays, but no one was interested in the red yarn. Finally, he met another old man who was trying to sell straw hats, also unsuccessfully, so they agreed to a trade. Discouraged, the old man headed for home with no mochi cakes for New Year's. When he came to Jizo Pass, it was snowing harder than ever, so he stopped and put a straw hat on each Jizo's head, but he was one short. So he took off his own white headcloth and wrapped it around the 6 Jizo's head, saying, I am sorry to give you this old thing, and I don't even have any mochi cakes to offer you. When he arrived home and told his wife his story, she didn't scold him, she wasn't disappointed, she just praised him for his generosity to the Jizos. And after a meager meal, they went to bed. In the middle of the night, they heard a great thundering rumble. They jumped out of bed and ran to the front door to see that a great heap of snow had slid down from the steep roof. And sticking out from the snow were all kinds of food: squash, apples, cucumbers, smoked fish, carrots, rice, even bolts of kimono fabric, and beautiful mochi cakes, everything they would need for a bountiful New Year's feast. And heading down the path, back towards the village, they could see six small Jizo figures receding into the distance, five wearing straw hats and one with a white headcloth. This story is my translation from the complete manga Mukashi Banashi. Mukashi Banashi are tales of long ago, and manga are, of course, cartoons. And it was a very famous, very popular TV series when Michael and I lived in Japan. And I have the complete set. This story is a classic tale of kindness returned. And as you know, food often symbolizes the nourishment of the Dharma. But also the Buddha recognized that without the basic needs of food, shelter, and clothing, we humans do not have a stable base from which to thrive and from which to practice the Dharma. We could also add basic safety, clean air, water, access to education, employment, and healthcare to this list of basic needs, without which we don't have the stability to thrive, let alone practice the Dharma. So we can expand our understanding of generosity from personal acts of charity to a collective commitment to social justice. But let's back up a bit and consider some different kinds of generosity. On the weekend, Michael mentioned lists in Buddhist practice, in the Buddhist teachings. So you will not be surprised to learn that there are lists within lists among the paramitas. So I found two sets of three kinds of dana, three kinds of generosity. The first set is one, material goods. So that would include also labor and time. Giving of material gifts, your labor, your time. It's good practice for flexing and toning your dana muscle. Good to shift out of self-focus and preoccupation. It's also good for shifting out of anger and repairing relationship ruptures. To give a gift. And that might seem simplistic, and yet sometimes it opens the gate of the heart of both giver and receiver. The second kind of dana is the gift of Dharma. And of course, Dharma, the gift of Dharma doesn't just mean going around preaching, though sometimes we are called upon to give talks and put the Dharma into words and express the Dharma in words. Much more important is the way we live, is our example. That's a gift of the Dharma, our deep understanding expressed through our words and actions and presence, the quality of our presence. And the third kind of dana is the gift of no fear or fearlessness, the gift of calm in the midst of the storm. And this is a huge gift in a time as we are living right now of so much anxiety and uncertainty. And I would venture to say this does not mean you have to be 100% fearless or fearless all the time to give this gift. This fearlessness or gift of no fear arises in the moment of presence when we can maintain a sense of groundedness and connection and presence, and fear drops away. So the night I gave this talk, we then brainstormed different kinds of non-material giving. And some of the ones we came up with were labor and time that I also mentioned under material goods, because we equate labor and time often with money, with material. And yet, certain gifts of labor and time are priceless, without monetary value. The gift of energy, presence, acceptance, appreciation, concern, understanding, caregiving, and let's not forget lightness and humor. And stability, peace. And how about privacy or space, giving your partner some space when you're crammed up in isolation or quarantine. Some people have had to deal with that. How do you give space in cramped quarters or quiet? So many kinds of non-material gifts. Okay, so another set of three types of giving or dana. And the first one is, the wording I like for this one is ambivalent giving. It's giving with some reluctance or a measure of withholding. It's the kind of giving where, you give what you don't really need anyway. It's easy. It's easy giving. Something that you don't really want or really need. Or you hold back. You're not fully giving. You're hedging your bets. So that's one kind, ambivalent giving. And it's better than not giving at all, because we get to notice. We get to notice where our withholding is, how we're measuring out. And that's those very holding back, noticing, holding back, excuse me, is where we then can let go, if we pay attention. And the second kind is called brotherly or sisterly giving. And this is the intention to share equally. And this sounds good. It sounds even-handed. But it's subject to being snagged by a kind of transactional or sibling rivalry. Mom always liked you best. You always got more than me. Or, I gave you all that, and what have you done for me in return? So again, it's better than not giving at all, but its limitations give us the chance to notice how we're maybe still keeping score, how we're not completely freely giving. And the third kind is noble. It's called royal giving in some texts, but I like noble giving. And noble giving, so remember the first one was ambivalent giving, the second was brotherly or sisterly giving, and this one's noble giving, which is fully out of concern and happiness for the welfare of others. So it's spontaneous often, and it's without reserve. So another thing I'd like to mention is the way some of the other paramitas, well, all the paramitas, of course, play a role in generosity. Remember what Aristotle, I talked about Aristotle in my talk on the weekend, what he said about wisdom. It's knowing what to do at the right time, about the right things, toward the right people, for the right end, and in the right way. And Aristotle's golden mean, you may recall, was not the midpoint between extremes, but a wise and skillful assessment of all those factors that I just mentioned. So when we're practicing generosity, we need the wisdom to first pay attention. And here come, this is where meditation or mindfulness comes in. We first have to pay attention. We have to pay attention and be attuned to when help is needed. We need to maintain an openness to offering and an attunement to the need. We probably all know how it feels when a gift or help is forced upon us, or when it's entirely inappropriate. Maybe you have a relative who gives a gift saying, "You're going to love this." And it's based entirely on their own tastes. And it feels like, do they even know who I am? Do they know what I like? Our best intentions to practice generosity can be contaminated, grossly or subtly, by that way that we separate self from other, by attitudes of pity or blame or disdain or judgment, or by the expectation of reward or praise, you know, how we're going to benefit. So a kind of unrelenting service, always giving, often out of a desire to maintain a kind of self-image of a virtue, fails to open to the dignity of the other, fails to open to reciprocity, to receiving. And it can be disempowering of the recipient and rob them of autonomy. Our society breeds contempt for those we perceive as weak or needy or fearful, you know, losers. We're so conditioned to think winners and think in terms of winners and losers, not to show vulnerability. And this conditioning also breeds self-contempt. And sometimes that involves a kind of martyrdom that will subtly poison the gift of service. When generosity is uncontaminated by self-clinging, it's impartial, it's not discriminatory, and it doesn't depend on the results. It doesn't have an agenda. To be effective in our giving, we need to be aware of our own situation and limits. We need to assess the large picture. Here's where the paramita of ethical conduct plays a role. We need to assess if our giving is going to cause harm. I like what Dale Wright has to say. He says, "No definitive rule or code for giving can be provided. Generosity is a creative act of freedom that is bound only by the ideals of wisdom and compassion and the cultural shape of the world it seeks to benefit. Therefore, the what of giving is always open in every situation. Stretching our minds to see the good that generosity might accomplish in any particular setting requires insightful freedom and creativity." So I think that really fits with our approach. And Norman Fisher's emphasis on imagination. And we need to be able to imagine, is this a beneficial act? And we can't know for sure sometimes. So we need to be flexible and adaptable and observant. The ultimate gift, though, or maybe we could say the foundation of all generosity, is letting go of self-clinging. From this foundation, we are able to offer our clear seeing and our non-reactivity. Again, I'm going to quote Dale Wright. He says, there are times when this, there are occasions of suffering when someone is overwhelmed by the pain of their own existence. Sometimes this pain has an overt cause, the death of a family member, a personal failure or disappointment, for example. And other times the cause is latent or hidden, the raw pain of anxiety. In either case, the ability to register the other's pain and to communicate a sense of understanding and care, whether through providing personal contact or appropriate distance, is an important skill in the perfection of generosity. There are times when all we experience is someone's distance, their utter alienation, without seeing the suffering at its roots. In these cases, we often mistake the symptoms. We interpret someone's distance, their rude behavior, their inability to communicate or to participate, as disdain or lack of care. And in response, we shun or secretly condemn them. So you know what he's talking about here, how we take it personally, how we take other people's pushing us away or rudeness or criticism personally. He continues, however, these and other forms of alienation are masked signs of suffering, hidden pain with an enormous range of causes, conditions, and manifestations. And sometimes we get a window into another's suffering, and sometimes we simply don't know and will never know what are the roots. But the roots are human roots, they're common, and we share those roots. And this allows us to open our hearts, even when someone's behaving in what seems to be a really harmful way. So Dale Wright continues, the ability not to react to another's distance with a natural corresponding distance is a mark of extraordinary perception and will. It shows someone's freedom not to have one's own response predetermined, the freedom not to be forced to reciprocate with a similarly alienated reply. And he says, few people possess the personal power to give such a gift. But when this rare act does occur, its effects are extraordinary in reversing the tide of alienation or suffering. Well, I don't think it's quite as rare as he says. I think we have that capacity in any moment to let go of our self-clinging, our self-focus, our wounded ego, and open our hearts. We can turn it. We can turn it in a moment. Each of you can do it. And we fail. Of course we fail all the time. But it's not impossible. And we learn from our failures. This foundation, what I'm calling this foundational generosity of letting go of self-clinging, also allows us to give the gifts of apology and of forgiveness, to acknowledge and make amends when we've done harm, and when we've been harmed, to give up our grudges and resentments, our wounded pride and self-image. When you've experienced deep harm from violence or abuse, forgiveness does not mean to justify or excuse or expose oneself to further harm, and so it doesn't necessarily even mean to reconcile. At least in terms of our practice, it means to see clearly the roots of harmful behavior and release your own heart's grip on vengeance and hatred. So I'd like to read you a poem, and Jess sent this poem to me, so I thank her, and I'd like to share it with you. It's about forgiveness. And it's called, it's by an American poet named Dilruba Ahmed. And I'm pretty sure she is of Bangladeshi origin, heritage. It's called Phase One. For leaving the fridge open last night, I forgive you. For conjuring white curtains instead of living your life. For the seedlings that wilt now in tiny pots, I forgive you. For saying no first, but yes as an afterthought. I forgive you for hideous visions after childbirth brought on by loss of sleep, and when the baby woke repeatedly for shouting silently in the dark, "What's your beef?" I forgive your letting vines overtake the garden, for fearing your own propensity to love, for losing again your bag en route from San Francisco, for the equally heedless drive back on the caffeine-fueled return. I forgive you for leaving windows open in rain and soaking library books again, for putting forth only revisions of yourself with punctuation worked over instead of the disordered truth. I forgive you. For singing mostly when the shower drowns your voice. For so admiring the drummer, you failed to hear the drum. In forgotten tin cans may forgiveness gather, pooling in gutters, gushing from pipes. A great, steady rain of olives from branches, relieved of cruelty and petty meanness. With it, a flurry of wings, 13 gray pigeons, ointment reserved for healers and prophets. I forgive you. I forgive you for feeling awkward and nervous without reason, for bearing Keats' empty vessel with such calm you worried you had, perhaps, no moral center at all. For treating your mother with contempt when she deserved compassion. I forgive you. I forgive you. I forgive you. For growing a capacity for love that is great, but matched only, perhaps, by your loneliness. For being unable to forgive yourself first, so you could then forgive others, and at last find a way to become the love that you want in this world. So I wonder when you realized, as I read, that she was writing about forgiving herself. It's often the hardest to forgive yourself. So if you, like me, find that difficult, you might want to write a list poem like that of ways that you forgive yourself, or even open to the possibility of forgiving yourself. So here's where the practices of the Brahma Viharas also enter into the practice of generosity, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, metta and mudita, forgiveness. These are complementary practices and generate the heart of generosity. Another complementary practice is receiving. Giver, receiver, and gift are not separate. As we chant in our meal chant, giver, receiver, and gift are empty. Empty of independent self-nature. It's hard to have an open, giving heart if we can't receive with grace and gratitude. If our hearts are contracted with feelings of lack, or with a kind of stubborn, rigid self-sufficiency. So you might want to also practice with gratitude, with receiving. And a good way to do that is having a little gratitude notebook by your bedside table. And before you go to bed, writing down three things that you're grateful for that day. And be specific, not general. And see if you notice more to be grateful for in your daily life. And then give those things away. Share those things with your friends and your family or a stranger. And I'm not necessarily meaning material things here, but maybe. So if you want more practices for cultivating generosity. There's a whole list in Norman Fisher's book. And I'm sure Kay will have some practices to offer us on Sunday as well, and grounding our awareness in awareness of our body, of our embodied experience. So I'm going to close with some lines from a book I've been reading called The Nature of Generosity by the American writer William Kittredge. The book is an extended sort of meandering meditation on the evolution of our consumer capitalist culture. He starts with early human beings and the growth of agriculture, commodification. He really spans human evolution. And critiques the ethic of rugged individualism, of Western colonial expansion that he grew up with in his boyhood on a ranch in western Oregon. And his theme, the theme that emerges, is how he sees an ethic of inclusive generosity as key to a change in values that we will need to embrace if we're going to survive on this earth as human beings. So here's what he says at the end of his introduction. He says, "We are not entirely programmed by drives coded into our genetic makeup and doomed to selfishness. We can turn our lives into gifts. Many have. We can live in accord with our desire to take care if we want to." So we could read that, we can live in accord with our vows, our bodhisattva vows, if we want to. And then he closes closes the book with this passage. "We must relearn the arts of generosity. We cannot in any long run survive by bucking against natural forces, and it is our moral duty to defend all life. It's time to give something back to the systems of order that have supported us, care and tenderness." The systems of order here, he means, you know, the fundamental ecosystems of this world. And he says, "As we work on behalf of one another and the world, we begin to experience the solace of re-inhabiting our emotional skins." Generosity is the endless project. So if we are to engage in this endless project of Dana Paramita, we must re-inhabit our emotional skins, our lived, embodied experience. So that's so I was really happy, I've already said this, that Kay chose this particular approach to practicing with the paramitas, because I do think it is the key to our perhaps literal survival on this earth. So please, this week, don't judge yourself for your lack of generosity. this is not meant to be a setup for self-judgment. Please be generous with your imperfection. The very hindrances, the very obstructions to our expression of generosity, those very obstructions themselves are the pivot points upon which we wake up and let go. So let us continue. Let us continue this endless project, this endless practice with our impossible bodhisattva vows we will chant together. Oh no, it's this Wednesday night. We don't chant them. What happens on Wednesday night, and what did happen when I gave this talk, is then we broke into groups and I asked people to discuss, to think about those different kinds of generosity that I mentioned. You know, the giving of material things, of the Dharma, of the gift of non-fear, the ambivalent giving, the brother or sisterly giving, and the noble giving, unrestrained. Think, and all the different kinds of gifts that we can give, think what ones come easily to you and what ones present challenges. And let those challenges be pivot points for awakening. So I will stop now and thank you for listening.